Hello, I'm Carl Blair. This is number 0616, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0616. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Michael J. Raup, also known as the Bug Guy, talks about the current extremely noisy mating season of the cicadas.
Once the cicadas get eyeball to eyeball, the male will switch to his courtship songs and try to convince that special someone that she should be the mother of his nymphs. So that's what it's all about right now. It's only the males that sing, so it's a big boy band up in the treetops, and right now it's all about romance.
Ralph Blumenthal is the author of The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and The Passion of John Mack. He's on to talk about the increased interest in the sightings of UFOs.
We have only quoted on the record sources in the government, people who we could identify, no anonymous sources. We got very good information from people who were working on the UFO issue. And by the way, let's not mix up UFOs and alien beings. The government is tracking UFOs. They have basically confirmed the reality of these unidentified things. They don't know what they are, but they know they're real. But no one is saying anything about who's behind the wheel or where they come from or what they're doing here, because that's pure speculation.
Stuart Nauman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nauman, and on Book Banter, we'll take a behind-the-scenes look at the birth of Comedy Central, according to its founder, Art Bell, in his book, Constant Comedy. To find out how we first got 24/7 comedy later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0616, was Carl Blair, who runs KDXRadio.com, one of the proud homes of the Stuff File program. And Carl, among other things, is also founder of the Society to Restore Mediocrity and the inventor of the solar-powered tanning bed. He is a true Renaissance man. Thank you very much, Carl, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Staff at the El Paso Zoo in Texas are preparing to press charges against a woman who jumped into the spider monkey exhibit on May 22nd and fed flaming hot Cheetos to the animals.
Last chance. Which one of you ate all the flaming hot Cheeto snacks?
Zookeepers found out about the stunt through Instagram, where someone posted video of the woman underneath a waterfall with the monkeys just feet away. Said zoo director Joe Montesano, this young lady decided to hop a fence, climb through some bushes, drop down into a 4-foot-deep moat, walk across the moat, and then try to feed the spider monkeys. It was stupid. She's very fortunate that it didn't have a worse outcome for her or the animals. While the woman hasn't been named, her employer, Lovett Law Firm, recognized her, and she was fired from her job there. Or perhaps she can ask for forgiveness and feed the lawyers flaming hot Cheetos. And speaking of lawyers, if the zoo decides to press charges, I'm guessing this woman won't find representation at her former firm. Frankly, I'm just baffled as to why she would do this.
It's a Cheetos thing.
Yeah, perhaps. On May 25th, New York City Councilwoman Helen Rosenthal virtually attended a finance committee meeting commenting on school classroom sizes and education funding as she shifted her focus back and forth between the camera and the road. She was driving her car during the meeting. During her time as a council member, She has advocated for improving bike lanes and expanding speed camera use. But since 2013, the license plate registered to her car has received 62 traffic violations, including 3 tickets for speeding in a school zone, all in 2020. Wow. Now, to be fair, that doesn't mean she was behind the wheel of said car during all those infractions. However, she, or someone in her family, has some splaining to do. Meanwhile, when Lee Bowman's neighbors in Sioux City, Iowa, failed to mow his lawn by the afternoon of May 23rd after he had asked them to do so, he visited their home to complain, then tried to peel a registration sticker off one of their vehicle license plates. Sometime later, however, police and firefighters were called to the neighbor's home, which was on fire. Investigators found a pile of sticks and plywood piled against the side of the house and evidence that gas had been used to start the fire. Bowman, who at 53 is a full-fledged adult and should know better, told police that he had seen the fire burning but didn't call 911 because it wasn't any of his business. But the kindling came from Bowman's home. The fire caused an estimated $3,000 damage to the home, and the family requested a no-contact order from the court. Meanwhile, Bowman was held at the Woodbury County Jail on suspicion of arson. Well, you know, this whole thing could have been avoided if those neighbors had mowed Bowman's lawn like they promised to. Gee, do you think they'll cut it while he's in jail? Nah, I don't think so. And you know, it's sad when neighbors can't get along, but that story pales in comparison to this next one, which, sadly, is a sign of the times. 70-year-old Jerry Dietrich was cited by Greenville, Ohio police on May 30th for littering. What he actually was doing was defecating and urinating on his neighbor's lawn when the homeowner discovered him at around 3:15 a.m. Matthew Guyette called 911 after spotting Dietrich relieving himself next to a hedge. Dietrich, a self-described Trump man, who lives a couple of blocks away, told police he had targeted Guyette's home because he and his partner, quote, are Democrats and support Joe Biden, unquote. Reportedly, Dietrich has been leaving his mark on the lawn for about 10 years, along with restaurant napkins he used to wipe. He is scheduled to appear in court on June the 8th. Gee, I think Rodney King said it best.
I just want to say, you know, can we all get along? Can we get along?
Although, to be honest, if I were Rodney King, my quote would have been, would one of you put down that damn camera and help me? But I digress. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Every 17 years in the United States, the cicadas show up, and they are kind of hard to avoid just by the noise that they make. Michael J. Raup is Professor Emeritus of Entomology and Extension Specialist at the University of Maryland. He's also known as the Bug Guy, and he joins us via Skype from Maryland. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Peter. How are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo. You must be a very busy guy around this time.
Well, you know, I kind of hide out for 17 years in my office and write papers and grants and teach a little bit, but you know, every 17th year, they let me up and out, and I get to hang out with the cicadas and tell some bug stories.
Excellent. So let's talk about the 17-year period. Where exactly do the cicadas go? I know they go into the ground, but are they hibernating? Are they busy down there? What's going on in the interim?
Yeah, they're kind of busy in a very slow way. Once they enter the ground, as what we call nymphs, they're about the size of a grain of rice. They've just hatched from tree limbs, maybe 8 feet above the ground, and they fall to the earth. Then they tunnel underground and they find roots of plants just below the soil surface. They're going to plug into the roots of those plants. They have a sucking type mouth part, and they're going to feed on plant sap for basically 17 years. So in the 17 years, they've gone from the size of a grain of rice to an insect, oh, maybe about the size of your thumb. So they're just growing very slowly underground. They really don't hibernate. They simply just take 17 years to fully mature before they emerge.
So basically all they do during that time period is feed?
Absolutely. Yep. They actually, it's a COVID-like existence. They're a social distance underground. They don't interact with their brood mates. They're simply in little tiny cells attached to the roots of trees, sucking plant sap.
While they're in the ground, do they have any natural predators?
Well, you know, for the most part, no. I think that's one of the reasons for the subterranean life cycle. Basically, you're avoiding all the creatures above ground, the small mammals and birds that would otherwise eat you. There are other insects, of course, that do feed in subterranean ways. Many beetle grubs, for example, feed underground during their maturation time. But we believe this is a way to avoid the heavy predation by many, many types of creatures that are found above the ground. They do have some enemies. And in this 17th year, Peter, when they're getting ready to make their jailbreak, they're going to be excavated by a whole variety of small mammals. For example, I've got a fox in my yard that's excavated a 30-foot trench beginning in March to eat the small cicada nymphs as they're getting ready to emerge. Skunks, raccoons, people's dogs have been digging up front yards. So in this 17th year, when they're closer to the surface, there are many different types of mammals that will excavate them and find a delicious feast just below the surface of the soil.
Where are the cicadas, where's their natural habitat as far as geography is concerned? I know they're mostly on the northeast and down the coastline of the United States. Why not any other part of the United States, and where are they elsewhere in the world?
Right. Well, there are more than 3,000 species of cicada worldwide, but the only place we have the 13 and 17-year periodical cicadas is here in the eastern half of the United States. Now, they have very specific geographic distributions. The reason they're only found here, I guess, simply is that you only find polar bears in the Arctic, panda bears in Asia, and giraffes in Australia. It's simply where they've evolved. Now, there are 15 broods of periodical cicadas. We have 12 broods of 17-year cicadas and 3 broods of 13-year cicadas. So almost every year, Peter, somewhere in the eastern half of the United States, there's this massive emergence in a pretty well-defined geographic region. That's what we call a brood. It just so turns out that brood 10 is the largest of all the 17-year broods. It ranges from Georgia in the south up to Long Island, New York in the northeast, and then west to Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. So this is broadly distributed, and I think this is why so many people will experience cicadas this year.
When it comes to something like climate change, is it affecting the cicadas? And by that I mean, you've mentioned the 13 and 17-year periods. Has it changed their time frames as to when they emerge because of the heating up of the planet?
Sure. Well, that's one of the things we're most curious about. We absolutely know that, as with many other insects and, frankly, plants in that matter, many animals, there's a slow northward migration as the world warms. We know that many years ago, of course, when glaciers covered most of North America, that there were no cicadas in places like central New York, but we now have broods of cicadas in central New York. So we expect, as the world warms, to see a steady migration, and perhaps one day in the distant future, you too will have cicadas where you are. The other thing, as you allude to, is my colleague Gene Kritsky, who is a cicada expert out in Ohio. He believes that cicadas are now emerging a full 2 weeks earlier than they did perhaps 3 or 4 decades ago. And finally, yes, you're right. We think with the warming of the earth, the warming of the soil, that some of the broods of 17-year cicadas may actually shift to the 13-year life cycle because the soil is simply so much warmer now. So we do expect changes in cicadas, and perhaps some of these changes are already underway.
Now, the noise that they make, they're very loud. Is that a mating ritual? And what exactly creates that noise?
Well, it's only the male cicada that sings. And he does this with an organ on his side. It's called the timbal organ. What it's like a drum head, and what he can do is vibrate this timbal organ to create sound. Now, I'm just opening my window, and I'm putting the microphone near the window, and you can hear the chorus of periodical cicadas. There are three distinct species that are emerging simultaneously, but to give every member of the same species together in the right place, you have to use a very special call, which is called the chorus call. So I hear two very distinct choruses outside right now. Once the cicadas get eyeball to eyeball, the male will switch to his courtship songs and try to convince that special someone that she should be the mother of his nymphs. So that's what it's all about right now. It's only the males that sing, Peter. So it's a big boy band up in the treetops. And right now it's all about romance.
I would imagine that for some people, that's a rather soothing sound. And for others, it can be somewhat annoying, especially considering it's continuous.
It is continuous, and it can be quite loud. If I got closer to that chorus, which is quite a distance away, the decibel levels would probably be in the neighborhood of 80 to 100. The level of a jet aircraft going overhead or a two-cycle engine running. So for me, it's kind of mystical and mysterious, but I totally agree. For some people, it'll be annoying. Fortunately, they kind of settle down a little bit as night falls, but I've heard them also chorusing very early in the morning, as early as 3 o'clock. So they will crank it up pretty early when the temperatures are warm enough.
So when you say crank it up, how long would they go on continuously as far as making that noise is concerned?
Well, this particular chorus, as I said, even though it was a little chilly today, it was down in the 50s. By 6 o'clock this morning, I heard the first calls, and that has been nonstop basically all day long. And this will continue certainly into the evening, perhaps take a little break. And then if the night is warm, they'll crank it back up at 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning. So they're pretty busy up there, and it does go on for prolonged periods of time.
Now, with so much attention on the cicadas, it's everywhere on television and in the media, and there are even lots of recipes for them. Have you eaten these things?
Oh, sure. I've snacked on a few. We had some emergence cookies. We were doing something with the CBS Morning Show, and we've done a special with Nova, so we've been snacking on cicadas as a delicacy, of course. But yes, there are many recipes on the internet. One of our students in 2004 wrote this Cicadalicious cookbook, just chock-a-block full of recipes for preparing and dining on cicadas. So, yep, we're just like all the other creatures on the planet right now, and we are going to snack on some cicadas from time to time.
Dare I ask, what do they taste like? And don't say, taste like chicken.
No, some people say they taste like bugs, Peter. But for me, my favorite is the soft-shelled cicada. In other words, just like you might eat a raw oyster or a raw clam. Sometimes I'll snack on one of the deformed cicadas that simply has no possibility of fulfilling the biological imperative. And for me, they've got a little bit of a crunchy, maybe a little buttery texture, and they taste nutty to me. So I think that might be from the tannins from the plant roots that they've fed on for 17 years underground. So for me, they're pretty nice.
And besides the humans who are eating them, you mentioned earlier there are some natural predators that they do have, but I understand that the natural predators kind of get tired of them because there's just so many of them that the cicadas win by numbers alone.
Yeah, it's a very strange strategy for survival. It's called predator satiation. The way it works is they're going to emerge synchronously in such massive numbers that they fill the bellies of every predator that wants to eat them, and there'll still be enough left over to perpetuate their species. But small mammals, as I said, foxes, raccoons, skunks, opossums, and then birds are going to have a field day. Some birds will actually lay more eggs this year. The fledglings will be heavier and enjoy greater fledging success by virtue of the bounty provided by periodical cicadas.
And again, the cicadas, when they're in the earth, are they something that is good for the earth?
Well, you know, good is a relative thing. I think if you took a vote of all creatures on the planet, I think I know who would be voted off the planet for certain. So, you know, a good or bad thing is quite subjective and rather deep. What I like to say is that cicadas provide enormous ecosystem services. Remember now, they take from the plants for 17 years underground. Once they emerge in the 17th year, they're going to feed everything that wants to eat them. They're little masters of transferring materials and energy up and down food webs. And finally, when they die, their bodies are going to rain back to the earth, and they're going to fertilize the very plants from which they were spawned. So they provide a very, very important ecosystem service and process of transferring energy up and down food webs. So it's kind of a circle of life, and yes, they, in my opinion, they're very good for the planet.
And last question, what is the cicada season? It started when? It is expected to end when?
Well, the very first cicada out of the ground, we recorded here in Maryland on April 19th, just north of Baltimore. It began as a trickle the first couple weeks of May, but now it's a flood. Simply, we're peaking. We will peak these last 2 weeks of May, the first week of June, and then we'll start to see a declination in the cicada populations as they've now mated, they've laid their eggs in the treetops, and sadly, they'll begin to die. So by the 4th of July, I don't think we'll have any more periodical cicadas here in the Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia area.
Well, Michael, enjoy the noise. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. And plan a trip south. They're not that far away, and they really are spectacular. They're one of nature's true wonders. Thank you so much.
Michael J. Raup, Professor Emeritus of Entomology and Extension Specialist at the University of Maryland, also known as The Bug Guy. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0616, and you'll find the link to Michael's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Actors, authors, quirky guests, and the common folk. It all comes to you here on The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about UFOs, plus Stuart Nullman is along with another edition of Book Banter. And we have lots more Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere for all your devices on everything from Spotify to iHeartRadio to Apple and Google Podcasts, just to name a few. As a matter of fact, anywhere that you do your streaming. And now, portions of the program can be heard on the new audio service called Audea. That's A-U-D-E-A. A platform that allows you to listen to segments of audio much in the same way that YouTube allows you to watch videos. There, you'll get to hear some fresh conversations from the Stuff File program, but you'll also get a chance to go back into our archives to hear chats going all the way back to 2009. So check out the new service of Audea by going to audea.io. That's A-U-D-E-A.io. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? During the COVID-19 pandemic, grounded planes were often parked in deserts, ideal conditions for storing them. But aircraft maintenance crews also discovered unwanted guests, snakes. So Australian airline Qantas added one more item to its engineering kit, a wheel whacker, also known as a broom handle. Before crews begin their landing gear inspections, they circle the plane, stomping their feet and whacking the wheels to scare off sleepy snakes. Said engineering manager Tim Haywood, the feisty rattlers love to curl up around the warm rubber tires and in the aircraft wheels and brakes, We've encountered a few rattlesnakes and also some scorpions. But the wheel whacker does its job and they scuttle off. Okay, you know that this story is screaming for an audio drop. And there really is only one audio drop worthy of this story. Of course, I'm talking about Samuel L. Jackson in Snakes on a Plane. But you know the problem. Jackson is one of the most profane actors in history, and in this role, he is at the zenith of his potty mouth. What to do? What to do? Oh, wait a minute. There is the television edit.
Enough is enough! I have had it with these monkey-fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday plane! Everybody strap in! About to open some freaking windows.
Somehow, that's not quite as satisfying, is it? Anyway, on May 23rd, when the 20-year-old daughter of Vero Beach, Florida resident Tyler Warden, who is 41, declined her father's invitation to eat the pizza he had brought to her home, the elder Warden became angry and turned around and threw a slice of pizza at her, striking her in the face. After Warden refused to leave, his daughter called the police, who noted the pizza toppings strewn across the entryway, the tomato sauce on the left side of the woman's face, and the strong scent of alcohol on Warden's breath. The pizza hurler was placed under arrest on charges of battery. Well, you know, there is a fine art to pizza tossing. Not everybody has that skill. Among the charges levied against Jose Aramburo Molina Jr. in Phoenix on June the 2nd was improper removal of a dead person. That's because when Molina allegedly stole a park running van from outside a funeral home, there were two bodies in the back. Molina had the key fob of the van in his possession. He told officers he had picked it up off the ground. He also had several illegal drugs. Well, at least he didn't try to use the carpool lane. Remember at the beginning of the pandemic when everybody seemed to be hoarding toilet paper? Well, that makes this story kind of ironic. During the pandemic, demand for porta-potties in Maine increased. Customers were renting them for longer periods, and factories that make them ran into manufacturing issues. As a result, South Portland is experiencing a critical deficit of the outdoor toilets. Supplier Royal Flush said they're waiting for another shipment that was supposed to arrive in April, and new customers will have to take a backseat to returning customers until the backlog is resolved, probably in late June. Well, I'm sure they can hold it until then. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, I'm sure by now you've heard that story about 46-year-old Quebec MP William Amos. Apparently, the member of the House of Commons can't seem to get a handle on the technology he uses for virtual meetings. Back in April, Amos appeared completely naked on camera during a House of Commons proceeding, explaining later that he was changing in his office after going for a run and was sure that he had disabled the camera. Well, on May 26th, Amos had to apologize again, this time for urinating, quote, without realizing I was on camera, unquote. As he wrote on Twitter, I am deeply embarrassed by my actions and the distress they may have caused anybody who witnessed them. His statement also said that he would seek assistance, although it is unclear what type of assistance that would be. I mean, does he need assistance to dress? Does he need assistance to pee? He certainly does bring new meaning to the Parliament Hill term of member. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We've been hearing a lot about what the U.S. government and the military may or may not know about the sightings of UFOs, especially after a recent piece that was done on 60 Minutes. So let's delve a little into this. Joining us is Ralph Blumenthal, who is a former staffer at the New York Times and the author of The Believer, Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and the Passion of John Mack. He joins us via Skype from New York. Hi, Ralph.
Hey, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. I saw you recently on a cable news network talking about this issue, and there certainly is a lot of buzz about this, again, especially after that 60 Minutes piece. But obviously, this is a new set of a buzz. You've been delving into this for a while because you've written an entire book, so this is not something that's new to you. How did you come to this story in the first place?
Okay, I was a New York Times correspondent in Texas, and a paperback book fell into my lap, basically. It was a book by John Mack, a Harvard psychiatrist, who got interested in the whole idea of alien abduction, people who remembered being abducted by alien beings. And I thought that was quite striking. So I was going to call him up for an interview. And lo and behold, right after that, he was run down and killed in London by a drunk driver. It was not an assassination, by the way. A lot of conspiracy theories pick that up, but it was a simple drunk driver. But I got interested in the story right then and there. And, you know, the idea of a Harvard psychiatrist interested in this field by a whole series of steps. He really illuminated the whole field of alien beings entering our dimension somehow, some way. It was never clear. But for a lot of reasons, he took it very seriously. So that's how I got into it.
Well, you mentioned again, you know, his untimely death and the fact that conspiracy theorists come out of the woodwork. This is a topic that is just rife with conspiracy theorists. So how difficult is it, being a credible journalist that you are, how difficult is it to delve into a topic like this when there's so much out there that is just wacky?
Well, you keep your eye on the ball is how you do it. We have only quoted on the record sources in the government, people who we could identify, no anonymous sources. We got very good information from people who were working on the UFO issue. And by the way, let's not mix up UFOs and alien beings. The government is tracking UFOs. They have basically confirmed the reality of these unidentified things. They don't know what they are, but they know they're real. But no one is saying anything about who's behind the wheel or where they come from or what they're doing here, because that's pure speculation. So my book about John Mack is one thing, but the stories we've done in the New York Times have been very strictly on the Pentagon efforts to track and understand what these strange craft are.
The title of your book is The Believer. In going into this, were you a believer? And if not, are you a believer now?
Well, the term is kind of pejorative, Peter, and I use it in a very particular way, as I explain in the book. I say that John Mack believed in social justice and breaking boundaries. That the term is used, it's thrown around often for people who are gullible. I didn't use it in that sense in my book, and I don't consider myself gullible. As I say about UFOs, I've said this in the New York Times, you don't believe or not believe in UFOs. It's like saying, I believe in the moon, or I believe in the sun and the stars or the ocean. They're there. They're unidentified, but they exist. We know that. So it's not a question of, you know, faith that you believe in them. So in that sense, I say, no, I'm not a believer in UFOs. They absolutely exist by all accounts. So it's not something that you choose to believe or not believe in.
At press time, we're hearing stories of the Pentagon trying to discredit a whistleblower who spoke out on UFOs. What do you think the reasoning is behind the Pentagon wanting to do this? I mean, there are several possibilities. One, there's something they're trying to hide, or two, they don't believe what this person is saying and are trying to squash it. Which one do you believe it is?
Well, it's not that there's anything discreditable about Lou Elizondo, who headed the UFO program. We've used him as a source. We've checked him out. He's entirely credible. He left the government because he didn't like the lack of support he was getting. Why the government is trying to discredit him is an interesting question. The defense establishment has a long history first denying the reality of UFOs, trying to discredit the people who are looking into them, and putting out disinformation very often because they felt that this is a very scary area. They not much the government could do about them, so they decided to discredit people who were looking into them. The government was basically caught flat-footed on this issue, couldn't make much of it. So they put out a lot of information that was dubious over the years. I can only, speculate why they decided to turn on Lou Elizondo, but it's a very unhappy story.
Do you think in their mind they have altruistic reasons for this? And by that I mean, do you think they want to keep discrediting this because they feel that it would cause panic and fear if this is something the general population would be aware of?
Well, I think the population is ahead of the government, not for the first time. I think the government has been concerned for a long time on what the reaction would be if it became known that there were these craft zipping around in the atmosphere and also underwater, by the way, apparently. And they were afraid that it would panic. But people have become used to this idea that there's something out there that cannot be explained currently. It's real, but no one knows what it is. So I think the government is being overly cautious, or if not cautious, more than cautious, they're being overly reactive and trying to discredit this whole field. But it's a shame because the public suffers, and it's the public who obviously this is all about.
Sometime in June, apparently, the U.S. government will release a report on UFOs. What are you anticipating this document will have? What will be contained in it?
Well, first of all, the deadline for in the congressional in the legislation, the Defense Authorization Act, after passage of the act in December, they had 6 months to come up with this report. But we hear that they're still way behind, that there's a lot of work left to be done. The deadline may slip. It may not come out in June after all. Or if it does come out in June, it'll probably be a very superficial report with more detailed information to come. How much will be public and how much will be contained in a classified version for, members of Congress with high security clearances is another question. I think that most of the important information that we're really eager to see will probably be withheld, at least at first. There's a lot of places in the government where this information is, secretly held, and it's very difficult for members of the UAP task force to get a hold of it. So that's what's holding things up. And there's a lot of difference within the government about how much should be made public. And clearly there is information in the government, someplace squirreled away that needs to come out because it's the American people who've been paying for this. And it's the people who really deserve to know the answers, short of course, security issues or defense issues. I mean, if there's technology there that would be helpful to adversaries, understandably, the government is holding some information back. But, to answer your question, I wouldn't set my watch by, a June deadline. And if it does come out in June, I think it'll be an interim report and rather superficial.
And of course, again, everyone seems to love a conspiracy theory. So the pushing back of the deadline of this report, is it a natural situation because of whatever they're needing to do for this study? Or is that in itself the basis of a conspiracy theory?
Well, you can't disprove a conspiracy. But I would say there's a lot of eyes on this, so it's going to be pretty hard to, sweep it under the rug. People are expecting a report. This has been news for a long time, so they can't completely, deny the deadline. I mean, something's going to have to come out at some point. So, and I don't believe really in conspiracies. I think too many people would have to be part of a conspiracy. So I've never believed much in conspiracies. So I think there's indecision in the government, but that's about it.
And going on the heading of as what you just said, of too many people, the United States is a superpower, but by no means the only power. And it's not like if there were aliens out there, they're only targeting the United States. I would assume that governments all around the globe are dealing with the same issues that the United States is dealing with. So nobody's talking.
Well, we happen to be a free society, so we notice when things hit the news and there's open discussion. There are places like China and Russia that are much more closed, and the press doesn't have access to the same information. We know pretty authoritatively that the Russians and the Chinese are as concerned as we are, or as puzzled as we are, and they're doing their own research. We're pretty sure, we being journalists who track this stuff, that what we're seeing, what our people are seeing in the sky, are not, Russian or Chinese drones, because they're too advanced for that. And they're not our own, because we wouldn't be running our own drones in airspace where they could, crash into our own planes. So that leaves the only other likelihood, that they are off Earth, off planet craft. I think everybody around the world is concerned about this, and the more sophisticated the society, the more technologically advanced, the more they understand that this is not earthly technology.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and it's still shrouded in mystery and speculation, and probably will continue to be for quite some time to come. The book is The Believer: Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and the Passion of John Mack. Thank you very much, Ralph, for being on the program with us.
Peter, it's a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Ralph Blumenthal, author of The Believer: Alien Encounters, Hard Science, and the Passion of John Mack. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0616, and you'll find the link to Ralph's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Latitude 47 degrees 14 minutes north. Longitude 84 degrees 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is with a laugh or two. Once again, it's Stuart Nauman. How you doing, Stu?
Oh, fine, Peter, but I don't give out the laughs. I just appreciate them.
Ah, yes. That is true.
You know what I mean? You know what? Let me just quickly give you a little bit of a quick story. 31 years ago, 1990, I was working at Just for Laughs, the Just for Laughs Festival in Montreal. I was a talent runner backstage. And I handled such comedians as Tommy Davidson, Martin Mull, and the late Bill Hicks as well. But it came with some perks. You know, you got to go to some after parties and, show late night shows. So it was fun. It was a lot of work, but it was fun. One of the things I noticed that was during that time, there was something called the Cable Comedy Wars. Because that year, there were two new comedy channels that were vying for your attention. And how they did it was something that's close to mine and any other journalist or industry person's heart, was giveaway T-shirts, free giveaway T-shirts. There was the Comedy Channel, which was owned and operated by HBO. There was Ha, which was another comedy channel that was owned and operated by MTV. And then Showtime decided to get into the mix. They had their own new segment to promote called Showtime Jokes. It was basically, that's how the comedy wars, the TV comedy wars of 1990 happened, you know, to get our attention was through these shirts.
You know, Stuart, you're telling me this story like I wasn't there standing right next to you while these shirts were coming our way.
Yeah, but, you know, you were there, but, you know, a lot of listeners probably weren't.
Okay, so okay, fair enough.
Yeah, I'm just setting the stage. So basically, I had my favorite. I had all three, but my favorite was the Showtime one because it had a picture of a potato wearing Groucho Marx glasses playing rim shots on a drum. I thought it was cute. So the following year, I found out who won those wars when I was working again for the festival, but this time when they had the Museum of Humor and I was at the Delta Hotel. And I was just walking down the corridor during a lull, and I saw this pile of T-shirts outside one of the ballrooms. Watching that there's nobody else looking or there's no one there, I take a look. And it was a pile of T-shirts, each individually wrapped in plastic. And I looked at the T-shirt and it said in this nondescript pink lettering, the name of the winner of the wars, Comedy Central.
You see, you're after the cotton products. I was after the Comedy Central breakfast, which was great.
I know, I still miss those breakfasts.
Oh, they were great.
But they gave out some great swag too, I have to admit.
Anyway, 3 minutes into this segment, your whole point of this is?
Well, the reason is that since I saw Comedy Central for the first time on a T-shirt, Comedy Central has been the dominant player on cable TV when it came to original comedy programming like South Park and The Daily Show and countless stand-up specials before Netflix began to nip at their heels in a big way. Now, Art Bell, the man who put the channel together and was by Comedy Central's side during his growing pains and early meteoric triumphs, recalls the birth of a major cable TV network in his recently published memoir, Constant Comedy. Now, during the early 80s, Bell was a mid-level executive at the constantly growing cable channel that was HBO, first as a marketing analyst, and then with a position at its new business development department, where he was tasked as part of a team to develop and test launch a new cable TV channel, which was tentatively called Festival. Now, with the growing popularity of stand-up comedy and the increasing number of comedy clubs opening up across the U.S. at the time, Bell realized that having HBO create a separate 24-hour comedy channel would be the next logical step. He wanted the new channel's format to be based on the Bats Entertainment and MTV models in which a variety of classic movie and TV comedy clips would play on a rotating basis. So when he first pitched the idea to HBO's head of original programming, Bridget Potter, she flatly rejected the idea when she told him, and I quote, "Arthur, you're not a programmer, you know nothing about comedy, and very little about television." But when Bell brought the idea to Michael Fuchs, the chairman of HBO, he warmed up to the idea. And shortly afterwards, he was teamed up with Dick Beers, who was the executive vice president of sales for Cinemax, Fran Shay, the vice president of on-air promotion for HBO, and Stu Smiley, HBO's vice president of comedy. And that kicked off the dizzying roller coaster ride that would provide the genesis of the Comedy Channel, which would later be renamed Comedy Central. But the book also focuses on the behind-the-scenes look at the development of the concept and shows that would put Comedy Central on the map during its first 5 years, such as the live comic commentary of President George H.W. Bush's State of the Union address in 1992, which led to the creation of The Daily Show, Comedy Central's own contract with America in 1995, Mystery Science Theater 3000, and Bill Maher's pre-real-time politically-oriented talk show, Politically Incorrect. Now, this book, Constant Comedy, I found to be a penetrating look at what it took, especially all that sacrifice and energetic effort towards creating a cable TV channel from scratch that still creates an impact within the comedy world, from the man who built it from the ground up and took all the slings and arrows that went with it.
You know, your setup to getting to this book review was so long. It was probably the longest, cleanest version of the aristocrats joke.
Yeah. But the punchline is much different.
Well, the punchline is much different. And now let's get people scurrying to Google to find the aristocrats joke. They'll probably find 20 different versions.
Or you can watch the documentary.
Yes.
That'll save them a lot of time.
Absolutely. Anyway, so this week's book is?
It's called Constant Comedy by Art Bell. It's published by Ulysses Press, and it's $24.95.
And what other tomes do you suggest in this genre, sir? And let me guess, if it's a book about comedy, are you going to try and find a way to sneak the Marx Brothers in here again?
No, afraid not. Not this time. But I've got two very good behind-the-scenes TV books that are must-reads. The first one is Bill Carter's seminal The Late Shift from 1994, which gives a great behind-the-scenes look at the, you know, the wars between David Letterman and Jay Leno for the control of The Tonight Show. And if you can't read the book, you should see the HBO docudrama based on it. Highly recommended. Highly recommended. And Helen Kushnick, Whoa! Hell Hath No Fury. And also, Saturday Night by Doug Hill and Jeff Weingrad. That was published in 1986 and was the first real honest-to-goodness backstage look at what went on with Saturday Night Live from creation up until when the book was published in 86. Because the other books were basically, celebrations and, tie-ins to the show. But this one has a little bit more of a zing to it. My favorite part was about the first season without Lorne Michaels with Gene Demanian, or they called it the Ayatollah Demanian, and how the 80-81 season was just plain disaster from the get-go.
You have to bring that up. I still get PTSD over that year.
Oh, yeah. I bet you, especially when Charles Rocket said the F word when Charlene Tilton hosted it, right?
Yes, well, yeah. That kind of woke me up.
Yeah. Well, I saw the first show. That Elliot
and by the way, we should mention he was fired immediately.
Yes. Yeah, and so was Demanian.
Yes.
But if there's anything that you could salvage from that season were two things. Joe Piscopo and Eddie Murphy.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just got another copy of the book, and the first thing I turned to was the chapter about that Demanian year.
Ooh, I think I'd rather read a book by Ali McGraw.
Is that the sort of like I'd rather eat broken glass kind of thing?
I'd rather slide naked down a slide of razor blades into a vat of iodine. Anyway,
now let me ask you: will they be sharp or dull razor blades?
Doesn't really make a difference.
Just checking. You may have a preference.
What is this week's book?
It's called Constant Comedy by Art Bell, published by Ulysses Press, and it's $24.95.
And besides scouring the schmata business for free T-shirts, where can we find you?
And that's my burgeoning collection? Yeah. Well, no, you can find me not in a warehouse. You can find me in the pages of the Montreal Times. Printed at the end of every week, in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
And yes, and thank you. And let me get those free T-shirts. I know that I saw a box somewhere.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. I do have one more Stuff File news story to share with you, and of course, an idiot of the day. Here on the Stuff File program, which is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, on May the 20th, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed into law a bill to override the 1993 ban on yoga practice in public schools. While conservative groups have posited that yoga and Hinduism and Buddhism are inseparable, the bill gained approval from the State House and Senate before arriving on Ivy's desk. But fear not, students will still be prohibited from chanting, and instructors will not be allowed to use Sanskrit names for yoga poses or to say namaste. The Reverend Cleet Hux isn't having it, though. Schools should not be in the position of endorsing possible altered states of consciousness, he said. Wow. That statement could include anything from cooking classes to gym classes, but I digress. State Representative Jeremy Gray, a certified yoga instructor, begs to differ. Anyone who has taken yoga, we know that namaste is not something religious. Yeah. It's clear that Reverend Cleet Hux has a closed mind and open animosity. Yeah. Now, some people might say, why don't you make him the idiot of the day? And I say, well, I can't make him the idiot of the day, even though I might think, personally, myself, that he might be an idiot. But we don't give Idiot of the Day out for people who just might merely have a difference of opinion. Opinion does not make one an idiot. Also, I get a lot of emails from people saying, you should make this person Idiot of the Day or that person Idiot of the Day. Again, I don't do it for political reasons, so those people are ruled out. Also, a lot of the stories people send me, somebody is either drunk or high, and to be an idiot, you have to be stone cold sober. So, that's basically the ground rules. It can't just be an opinion, and you can't be under the influence of anything. That's basically how you become an Idiot of the Day. Which, by the way, boys and girls, brings us to the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff Off presents the Idiot of the Day.
54-year-old Adele Bellazaire was held in the Pinellas County, Florida jail after a stunt she pulled to blow off steam on May the 11th. Bellazaire, frustrated with her loss of nearly $400 playing slot machines at the Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa, called the casino on her cell phone that evening from her hotel in Clearwater Beach and said, "I left a bomb in your casino." What she failed to remember is that as a member of the casino's Players Club, her phone number is on file. In her confession, she admitted that she has anger issues. Now, why, oh why, would you call in a bomb threat on your own cell phone, especially since said number is already on file with the place you're calling in the bomb threat about? One reason, and one reason only. It isn't just because you have anger issues. You're also an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0616. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0616. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CFMU in Hamilton. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Guests of the Stuff File program stay at their own homes.
Trust me, I'm the voice for this program. I know there's no budget for accommodations. I'm reading this on a futon.